A neighbor says she saw a suspicious man walking near Nancy Guthrie's home weeks before she vanished. Not hiking, not walking a dog, not someone who looked like they belonged in the neighborhood. This is all according to recent reporting from Brian Enton with News Nation, who broke this story just the other day. Instead, this neighbor says that the man was, quote unquote, studying the street. So is this person possibly responsible for what happened the night Nancy disappeared? Is he part of the investigation? And if so, even if not, if this guy had nothing to do with it, what does the geography of the crime scene tell us about who that person or the perpetrators might be? You're about to learn a lot tonight about geographic profiling.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. It is the global phenomenon, bringing you the best guests in all of true crime. Tonight, we're doing something very different in the Nancy Guthrie case. For weeks now, you've heard a lot of the same questions and the same concerns, same investigative questions going back and forth. Who's the masked person on the video? Where is Nancy? Is she still with us? And why has the case been so difficult to solve? But tonight we're taking a couple of steps back from all the speculation and looking at the case through a really different lens, an investigative lens known as geographic profiling. Instead of asking who, geoprofiling asks something a little bit different. Where? Where did the offender approach from? Where did they leave? What routes would make sense? What locations intersect with the offender's daily life? Because criminals move through space in patterns, and these patterns often reveal things about the offender. And here to break it all down, you've got the geo profiler himself, both on YouTube, on Twitter, wherever social media lives, coming to us from the great white north, Douglas McGregor, who's also a best guest. Welcome to you, Douglas. Kathy Decker. They work together in tandem. Kathy is a retired King County homicide detective, which is the greater Seattle area. And she's here and she'll tell you about the group that she has, because already I have misplaced the name. Kathy, just tell us the name, the acronym for the group that you run, and Douglas is a part of it, as is Cloyd, who I'm about to introduce.
Yeah, you bet. It's IRIS, and it stands for Investigative Strategies, or Incident Response and Investigative Strategies. And we are a team of experts that will deploy to assist law enforcement and or support families to work unresolved criminal cases to help them get answers.
I love that. And part of this team is retired Seattle homicide detective, and he spent, I want to say, 38 years, if I'm right about that, with the Seattle PD, Cloyd Steiger, who's been on the show before, and he is back. So, Cloyd, was I close there, 38 years?
36.
Hey, Chris Nanos, the sheriff in Pima, added 2 years, so I added 2 years to you. there was, quote-unquote, a hit piece out against him. Doug McGregor, before we get cracking here, I tried to explain it, but you'll do a much better job. What is geoprofiling?
You did a pretty good job. It's just looking at the geographic, environmental, spatial, and temporal elements of a behavior and of a crime to support investigations and provide investigative leads and to help with search prioritization.
Kathy, Doug's a humble man, but he said, you know, I got it pretty right. But what can Doug and you guys do that, I guess, typical, you know, when you were in your old position as a homicide detective, or Cloyd was in his old position as a homicide detective, where do they intersect and where do they diverge from one another?
No, great question. And when I met Doug, I was astounded as to how much of an overlap there was between what I did and what he does. So one of my skill sets was visual tracking, a little bit different than tracking as you might think of it today. where I studied the physical evidence on the ground of the presence and passage of people. And I interpreted that evidence to make some determinations about how many people were at a crime scene, how they were interacting, direction of travel, took into account those same things that Doug is talking about, geographic areas, terrain, human behavior, all of those things. And of course, that applies to crime scene work because we're dealing with people. And so behavioral patterns become extremely important. So there was definitely a crossover.
Yeah. And I mean, prior to your work, Cloyd, 36 years with the Seattle Police Department, and I know a lot of them in the homicide division as a homicide detective. But what, if anything, did you know, or how did you use geographic profiling in your time at the Seattle PD?
Well, we, you know, it's a little different in an urban environment than it is in a more rural environment. But as far as locations and the odds are proximity of the suspect, either a workplace, a home, a hangout, to the crime scene is something you have to take into consideration.
Kathy, I don't want to put you on the spot or anybody here, but there's a question, an interesting one. Does the panel have an idea of the missing numbers for Arizona or the recovery rates and how they compare nationally? Anyone have an idea there about missing persons? No, that's something that I guess we can do a quick Google search on and try to, you know, come up with something. But again, Doug, instead of asking who did it, which is always, you know, the who done it, why did they do it? From what I understand, geoprofiling really is asking other questions like where did this offender likely come from? What routes did they take to get there? What areas are part of their normal daily life? But how do we start there? And I would pull up map one, but COE, I start here on slide three. So I'm still just waiting on one and two. And we'll get it. We'll get slides one and two. Doug was gracious enough to give us slides, but there we go. This is map one. So Doug, tell us what are we looking at here and how do you start with geographic profiling?
Sure. I mean, here we're just showing Nancy Guthrie's home in the Catalina foothills. And the first thing I would start with is an environmental scan. So something for like processing the crime scene itself. I mean, I defer to Kathy and Cloyd as retired homicide detectives. Usually I come in after that's all been done is when I usually come in and start my role. So for a scene like this, you know, I'd be going through doing a complete environmental scan of everything that we just spoke about, you know, the where and the when. So where did this offender likely approach the residence and try to put together, reconstruct a time frame for that. Now, this picture here is a good one because one of the theories that's been floating around lately is, you know, was this a botched robbery, right? Was the initial motive a home invasion, a robbery, and it went sideways as crimes often do. While I'm not going to theorize one way or the other whether that's what happened, what I will say about the Catalina foothills is although robberies generally happen or home invasions generally happen in the afternoon. You know, people go in, they break into your house while you're at work. You know, they go to the master bedroom where we usually store all our jewelry, the small items, and they take them and they run. Now, a 2 a.m. robbery is rare. You're really only entering the house at 2 a.m. if you know one of several things. You're either the people are home and you don't care, which is very high risk. The person in the house is your target. You know the person in the house is vulnerable, or you know the person in the house and you know their schedule and you think they're going to be elsewhere. So it's kind of one of those four reasons. But when we look at a 2 a.m. Entry in the Catalina foothills, it does increase the chance of a nighttime robbery for several reasons, which we see here on this slide. Some of those being that, one, it's the wealthiest area of Tucson, from my understanding. Two, it's dark, very little light pollution. And they kind of keep it that way in that area of Catalina Foothills. You know, three, the houses are set back from the road, right? So there's privacy. There's very limited surveillance from the road or from neighbors because of all the bushes around, because the size of the lots, the setbacks. And then you have, you know, as somebody entering the home, if you know about the property, you have so many opportunities for concealment, which we see in this photo. You know, the vehicle itself just driving in is hidden. There's bushes for concealment. There's entry points. You know, the sliding doors are probably your two primary entry points. I'm not saying that's how he entered, but those are probably the most vulnerable spots for entry. Now, the last thing I'll mention on this slide is the little paths I drew there on the driveway in. So it loops around, but you've got the red area and the green area. The red area is interesting because from what I've seen from the Nest camera footage, that's the only area that you may pick up a vehicle, right? So that's really, if you're going to go take that Nest cam from the front door, in my opinion, is you're taking it because it's seen something. Either that's the way you entered, which could be he entered the front door, or it caught his car and he's removing it. However, if he just entered and left on the green route, it probably wouldn't have picked him up. So I think it does say something that he took the Nest camera, which means he either entered through the front door or it caught his car, his vehicle on camera from that vantage point.
It's amazing because the amount that you were able to kind of glean from a single picture. But Kathy, my question to you, just going back again, I imagine having done what you did as a retired homicide detective, same with Cloyd, you've also got to be asking yourself, you know, why did they do this, what the motive, all these other things. So again, it's sort of similar to my first question, but when you're working with Doug, how do you separate the two? Because Doug is looking at this from a really like micro, you know, singular level, not an all-encompassing investigation. So how do you keep them separate, I guess, is my question.
Well, no, it's a great question. And you don't always need to. Think of it as a jigsaw puzzle. And so each investigator is a piece of that puzzle. So as you glean information and learn new information, it all comes together to form the picture. And when you have the entire picture, then you have hopefully the answers that you're seeking. So it's very much a give and take. And it's a matter of looking at all the evidence and interpreting all the evidence and taking in different perspectives is really important.
Cloyd, since the last time we spoke, obviously a lot of time has passed. This is day 39, here, into the second month. Has your theory about the case or what transpired, has it changed or evolved at all?
No, it really hasn't changed at all. I mean, I don't buy this interrupted robbery story. First of all, in my experience, when people do a robbery and they're seen, they flee. They don't kidnap the person there, unless it's targeted. You know, it's a targeted home invasion. That's different. So that's I tend to think this is targeted, that she specifically, because of who she is, and the word was out that she's the mother of of Savannah and all that stuff. So I've been that way the whole time. I've also had a very bleak expectation that she'd be found alive from the beginning. And that hasn't changed either.
But Claude, you think then that this is like an intended targeted abduction / kidnapping, not a robbery gone bad?
Absolutely, yes.
Interesting. And I mean, let me just follow up there with you. Then how come we haven't seen anyone take the bait on this $1.2 million?
Well,
what's the reason?
Because, you know, they demanded proof of life. And I believe I've handled a case like this before, and of an elderly woman just like this, and she was dead the first day. And, you know, they demanded proof of life, and they can't provide proof of life. That's telling in itself. If they had proof of life, they would they would show it. And, whether anybody else knows about it, somebody might. Somebody still could bite on it, you know. But the killer themselves, as far as are the kidnapper, the suspects, are not going to get the ransom because they can't provide proof of life. And nobody's going to pay a ransom if there's no proof of life. So, and that tells me, the fact that they haven't tells me a lot.
Mm. Three amazing investigators here. Doug, there was a question a moment ago about the, at one point we had they had the signal sniffer up that was looking for that pacemaker. And the person wanted to know if that falls into the category of geographic profiling, does it?
I really think it would, because that really comes down to search prioritization. I don't know that technology very well, but from what I understand, you have to be pretty close to your target for that to work. So, you know, if it's going to pick something up, you're really going to have to narrow that area down, or, you know, or where do you search, right? So if they're searching a specific area, they must have a reason for doing that.
Mm. And now, Doug, this is, I guess, slide number two, I imagine, because the COE just brought it up. Obviously, we're looking at and correct me if I'm wrong here, but we're looking at a traffic signal camera, which I imagine are all over the place. So how close a friend is this camera to you as a geoprofiler?
Yeah, I found that interesting. And honestly, they're really not that useful. I thought I'd just put it up because I'm sure people following this case have seen them, but these are all over the Catalina foothills, these traffic signal cameras, basically at every major intersection leaving the Catalina foothills. Now they kind of operate on a technical and on a psychological level, because, you know, most people, I don't think most people would be able to confidently say they know that these don't record anything, right? So on the psychological level, they work that way. But just for anybody who doesn't know what these are, these cameras, they operate your traffic lights at intersections, especially in the middle of the night when traffic is slow. So they're basically detecting cars coming towards the intersection. They're triggering a green light, early left turn signal, that kind of thing. So they're everywhere. And they kind of replace a lot of cities. Like I know my city here, they're either in the ground, in the concrete, the sensors, or they're on the post, the actual pole that holds up the traffic lights. So these are all around Catalina foothills, and they don't actually record anything. They hold no data. They don't record anything. They're just there to pick that up. But the interesting thing is that some of these, it depends on which make and model you have, but some of them log timestamps for when turn signals or when lights are activated, which can help me out in what I do. Because if you have one of those companies that does log that timestamp, then you can actually, you could pick up the route of travel. So if you knew he was leaving her house around 2:30 in the morning, and all of a sudden you saw a green light triggered at 2:35 and then 2:38 and then 2:45 or whatever it is, you could actually log that route of travel. I mean, it wouldn't guarantee you that that's the person that you're after, but it may give you a lead to look into, as in travel direction and kind of narrowing your person of interest list and somebody to look at. But the last thing on the psychological level, it does work that way too, because, you know, I don't think I'd be confident before looking into these things that they didn't record anything at all. And if I'm the offender that's canvassed that area, I would probably avoid those traffic cameras and go a route where they didn't have them, just to be sure.
And Doug, before I forget, I'm sure you heard about this video that Fox News Digital obtained from about 2.5 miles away of these three different cars around the time this crime happened. From your perspective, and that's something that the FBI in Pima County is looking at, how important is that video? And, you know, let me caveat it by saying I met the COE, the chief of everything. I met her while we were both reporting in Tucson. We were there for 5 years. I was there for 5 years. This is a very quiet, very dark, very sleepy neighborhood. So even to have I mean, have any vehicle traffic at that hour is somewhat unusual, but three cars driving by at a high rate of speed, 2.5 miles away. How important or not important is that to you, Doug?
Yeah, it's definitely important to me, and working alongside, you know, Kathy and Cloyd on that issue as well. I would basically reverse engineer that. I would take that event and go backwards. You know, does it fit the timeline as one? And then from that specific location, what can we get from that? And can we trace a timeline? Can we trace a pattern, a movement route all the way back to her house? So it would definitely be an investigative lead to look into. And like, you know, you have to look into every lead.
Yeah. And this is a great shot here. I love the shot. I love Tucson, by the way. Just an amazing community. It's enormous, but it feels like a small town. It's hundreds of square miles within these. There's four different mountain ranges. This is one of them. And then obviously that, which is the Catalina Mountains. And then it sits in the valley here. If you come, you know, toward Cloyd, south on this screen, more and more southeast, the University of Arizona is over there. Context, I used to live on the top sort of right corner here, but it could take an hour and a half just to drive through this. So Kathy Decker, and each one of these homes, if you go back to, you know, looking at Nancy Guthrie's home, it's almost like a little mini desert landscape within a desert landscape. All the houses in the foothills are sort of like this. This makes searching and finding something, I would imagine, incredibly difficult.
Yes, it can. But keep in mind, when you conduct a search, what isn't there is as important as what is there. And the key is really to get on the search immediately. So you want to be able to get the right resources out as soon as possible that can pick up the forensic evidence that others may not be able to readily identify. Desert setting, there's a ton of dust. There's going to be a lot of impression evidence, for example, that would be readily detectable if you have the right resources in immediately. You could easily do perimeter cut around the home and other homes in the area. You're going to look for patterns of movement. We talked a minute ago about the vehicle that's speeding in and out. Somebody had to get in and out of that vehicle. So if you can identify the point where that occurred, that could also give you some really important forensic evidence.
Thank you for this comment. And big thanks here goes to Doug McGregor. But the COE is constantly putting graphics together, other graphics, great graphics on the channel. If you're new to the show, we do the live panel show just like this. Monday through Thursday, and then a 1 p.m. show with my mom, who's the oldest true crime podcaster in the country and a child Holocaust survivor, hence the name. And she likes to yell at me, hence the name Surviving the Survivor. So please, on the way in, on the way out, hit that like button, subscribe. And Doug has his own YouTube channel, The Geo Profiler. Check him out and make sure you subscribe there as well. We've also got an active Patreon page as well. So we appreciate the love and support. We do the job of CNN, Fox, and whatever other channels combined with four of us, and we do a better job, in my humble, very humble opinion. Kathy, just back to you on this. So you get the phone rings. Your company gets a call. They say, we want Doug McGregor, the geo profiler. We want Cloyd Steiger, Seattle PD. We want the three of you down here right now. You land in Tucson. What do you do?
Well, first thing we do is we want to get briefed. So we would ask to have contact with the individual or individuals that are going to have the best information. We would want the factual information, the best evidence to identify a strategy for our team in moving forward. We would need to identify what the goal is for our team, what our objectives are, the timeline to accomplish that. And then if we needed additional subject matter experts, we would be able to reach out and get those to the scene immediately.
Cloyd, what would you be interested? I mean, if you're on the ground there, you were literally asked to give your expertise as a retired homicide detective, what are you most interested in? I mean, we had Ann Burgess on the show last night, who's a legendary criminal profile. She says she wants to know how the perp got into the house. What was the method used to physically get into the house? What is, I guess, your number one question, Cloyd?
Well, that's, of course, one of the big questions. And what I would do, because I'm coming in after the original, obviously. Now, if I was a detective at the scene, it'd be different. But so if I come in now as a part of IRIS, I'd want to know who they've talked to, what they've said, how they said it, where they talked to them at, and the context and why they talked to them, and then go through. And because a lot of times you see on these, there's a lot of, well, it happens in every case, on these whodunit cases, there's a lot of going down rabbit holes that have nothing to do with the case. So you have to separate what is, what looks like a good lead from rabbit holes. At one time I went into an outside jurisdiction for a state trooper that got shot. They asked us to come down. I went there and I'm listening to what they've done. And the first thing I said is, stop everything you're doing because you're doing everything wrong. Because they were looking for some ghost. And this is just a guy. And he's just like this case, this is just a guy or a group of guys. They're not phantoms that went and turned to smoke and went into the house. People have a tendency to over romanticize or overthink these things. You got to go back to basics and keep it simple.
By the way, I love this comment from Bluebird 57. My mom is the oldest YouTube watcher at 97. I would love to FaceTime her one day. I bet you she can keep the camera steady, unlike Carm, who's got me upside down and wobbling around. But shout out to your mom. And we've got to get her on a show one of these days. When she hits 100, we will have her on. How about that? That is for sure. Kathy, back to you. You know, the same way I asked Cloyd, I'm curious if you have your own, I imagine you do, if you have your own theory on what transpired here, whether or not this is an intentional kidnapping. Let's start there. Do you believe it's an intentional kidnapping / abduction?
Yes, I tend to agree with Cloyd on that. It does seem to me that the initial plan was to go in, get her, and then perhaps seek a ransom. What they may not have known was the medical problems or issues that she suffered from. Their intel may not have been very good, or perhaps they did not have a connection with the family to get that information, or did not know the family well enough to know that about her. So I think that in itself could be an important clue. But yes, I tend to think this was probably a kidnapping. Mm.
Darlene, everyone's going to yell. COE is going to yell at me, but it's just too much fun. So tired of Nancy Guthrie. Go watch Archie Bunker. Go watch some show on Nickelodeon. No one's forcing you to be here. We love you. We love SDS Nation. I want you to be here, but if you're not interested, read a book. I don't know. Read my book. Go buy my book, Surviving the Survivor. Read a book instead of whining about what we're talking about. When you got three incredible guests, you're not going to find these three guests together talking about this. I already forgot her name. Sorry about that. So, Doug McGregor, we're looking at the video now of the person believed to be a perpetrator. Ann Burgess even questioned whether or not this guy was ever even inside the house or had, you know, was directly linked to grabbing Nancy Guthrie. That's something that she raised last night. But how are you looking at this differently than us, the common folk, Doug McGregor? How's a GO profiler looking at this differently than just a typical person looking at this?
I think I just approach it in my own way. I mean, the first thing when I'm looking at this case is, I mean, the first issue is you're dealing with a case of elder abuse. Now, this may be a complete random event with a stranger that committed this, and that is definitely one scenario. But you have to first consider elder abuse as one possible scenario. With elder abuse, you know, your three most likely offenders are going to be either family, caretaker, or someone in a position of trust. So as law enforcement, you have to go through those three categories of people and see if any of them are, you know, are a suspect person of interest. After that, you're looking at, you know, possible to have a theory. For me to have a theory personally, I need something in the form of either, you know, a motive, which you can get from evidence. So a motive, a suspect, or a target. We don't have the suspect. Motive, publicly, we don't know at this point. And target, you know, it could be any, it could be Nancy, it could be Nancy's property, and the primary target could be Nancy's family, and Nancy was a secondary target. So we don't really know the target yet either. I do agree with Cappy and Cloyd that this does appear to be targeted, and I don't think it is a robbery gone sideways. So I do agree with them on that. You know, there's just so many questions to ask. You know, we think this all kind of unfolded around 2:30 in the morning. But I mean, we don't know, was the offender in the house when she arrived home? I don't think that's been proven that she wasn't, right? I mean, he wasn't, he could have been. And did he come back at 2:30 just for the camera? We don't really know that. There's just so many unanswered questions at this point. Right. I think the only thing that most people can agree on is that she was taken from the house, likely by the guy in the camera. But again, we don't agree on that. As you said, you might not even be involved in taking her. So there's just so little that's known at this point that for me to put together a theory, it's just too early, and a potential type of suspect. It's too early. At this point, I'm just gathering facts and then trying to put together the various components of to develop my findings.
Yeah. So this is slide four. I'm not sure. Did we hit slide? Yeah, we hit slide three. Okay. So the COE is always right. I should know that by now. Slide four is this, Doug, and then I'll move on back to Kathy and Cloyd. These are, I see here, possible routes here, and then an optimal route. What are you doing with this particular slide other than basically mapping the area here?
Sure. So what law enforcement is doing in this area, they're going around and they're canvassing, is one of their activities. And Cloyd and Kathy can speak better to canvassing than I can. So they're canvassing the area, and they probably have particular specific areas they're canvassing, or maybe they're canvassing everywhere. I'm not quite sure. So the previous slide to this, it just shows the different points, the pink icons on there. Those are all the traffic signal cameras, just so everyone has an idea of how prevalent they are in Catalina foothills. They're all over the place, just to change the traffic lights. And then you have the gas stations, and gas stations just represents other areas where, you know, law enforcement is going to look for surveillance CCTV footage, because they all have cameras at gas stations, but there's other places that have that as well. So we can move to the next slide there, Joel. So what this does is, when this offender's leaving, it's at State Route 77. State Route 77 is the most likely route out of there, right? After you've committed this crime, you've taken, you know, a person from their home, you want to get out of there as fast as possible. And the fastest way out of there is Route 77. So you're likely trying to get back to Route 77.
Doug, real quick. I think people in Tucson would know it as either. I think it's either, that's either Oracle or Campbell. I'm not sure which, but those are the two main COE. I don't know if you know, but I think it would be Oracle or Campbell. But I just want to, for people who are watching locally, I think that would help them. But go ahead.
Okay. So that's the fastest, because that takes you back to the interstate as well. And then you can get back to Southern Tucson if that's where you're going. So anyway, these green routes are your most direct routes out of there. And like I said earlier, if there's a psychological element, you know, to avoid, or if you don't know what those cameras are and you're trying to avoid those cameras, that red line is the only way out of there that from what I can see, avoids those cameras at the intersections. So if he wasn't sure what those cameras did, or he just wanted to make sure, that's the route out of there that he would take. But overall, you know, I would, again, this comes back to search prioritization, and I would say focus your canvassing along these routes. Start with the red and work your way out. Cover all the greens.
Kathy, to you, I just took some notes, and shout out to Melody for the comment. Thank you. But Doug essentially was explaining, you know, that in his role, he's studying road networks, terrain, travel routes, the surveillance cameras that we're looking at. And he refers to them as, quote unquote, cognitive corridors, which are the paths that these offenders are comfortable traveling. So that's obviously very key. What Doug just said from an investigative standpoint, from sort of a theoretical standpoint about the possibility that the perpetrators, we don't know the timeline, really. You know, we were told this timeline, but to Doug's point, have you theorized or hypothesized on this notion that maybe the intruder was in that house for much longer? She was at dinner beforehand, that he was like lying in wait for her, and maybe we're just seeing this person here who's trying to nab a camera on the way out.
Well, exactly. And as we discussed, we just don't know. I would hope that the investigators that did the examination in the house would have been able to identify some clues or evidence that basically would give them that type of information, which is why it's so crucial that you do a proper forensic examination right away around the perimeter of the home, as well as inside the home, to try to glean that. And what Doug has done here, which is so incredibly helpful for investigators, is we're really talking about containment. So where's the area where we need to focus our resources, because we have limited resources? So where do we want to really put our troops out? Where do we want to canvas? Where do we want to try to retrieve video? And with Doug, we're able to identify those higher probability areas so that we're not wasting time.
Yeah. Cloyd, I just want to get your take on that, because I really hadn't considered it until now. But, you know, we know the crime occurred, according to authorities, you know, in the 1 a.m., 2 a.m.-ish hours, early morning of February 1st. But do we really know that? I mean, how interested would you be into really narrowing that down to find out, hey, was someone able to get into the house at, let's say, you know, 9 while she was at dinner, and then sit there and lie in wait? And how would you even begin to go about trying to figure that out?
Well, you got to look at the probabilities. Do I think they went in as early as 9? No, because why would they wait around till 2 to do anything? I'm sure this woman wasn't puttering on that house till 1:30 and went to bed at 2, right? Mm-hmm. So it's probably... Could it have been? Yeah, but I don't think it's likely. I mean, the clues you have are the pacemaker leaving her phone connection, you know, because it got out of range of the Bluetooth. That's a good clue as to when she left the house. The blood on the porch, which you don't get it till the next day, that's going to be dry. But I mean, like I said this before on your show, she wasn't dead when she went out, because dead bodies don't bleed. She was still alive at that point. Yeah. She was dripping blood. And so those are things, you know, but that's where, like, one thing about, you know, like using Doug and everything, I always tell people that when you're a homicide detective on a scene, you're kind of like a general contractor. You're responsible for the big picture, but you farm out all this other stuff to guys like Doug and other, you know, crime labs and medical examiners. And then you just put it all together, and you put the pieces together, but with information from other people. And that's why we don't do the same job and overlap each other. It's just important tools in the same toolbox.
Yeah.
And Joel, if I may.
Yeah, please.
One thing I learned today as a member of the public, and the reason I would extend the timeline to before she arrived home, is that it was posted today that she missed her 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. medication. So that would be a question. You know, we all miss medication sometimes. I get it. But is that something? Has she never missed medication, right? Is that something that is an anomaly? Because there's a reason she missed her 10 p.m. medication. Is it because she was interrupted? Is it because she just forgot? Is it because she went to sleep? We don't know, but it's something that has to be.
And how do we know she missed that medication? Was that revealed by authorities?
Someone can maybe clarify. I saw it on Twitter, and I think it was revealed on Nancy Grace. So I don't know. Again, I don't know if that's confirmed. Okay. But yeah, that's what's out there now.
Well, that's definitely interesting. Go ahead, Cloyd.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the only way you could know that is, well, because she has the number of pills she has. Mm-hmm. But it could have been she missed one of the medications 2 days ago. You know, you can't jump to the conclusion she missed it that night, because there's one extra pill in her bottle. she could have missed it on a previous occasion, and she's one behind now. I mean, it's interesting, but I, you know,
unless she has one of those, you know, those little schedulers, right?
That has it. Yeah. Maybe. I mean, maybe. I don't know how they know that. Like you said, she could have just fallen asleep. I don't know what time she got home, 9 o'clock or something like that. Yeah. She went out to dinner, had a couple glasses of wine. Maybe she just fell asleep. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm going to get back to slide five in a minute, but Kathy, Cloyd had a case, and Cloyd, remind me the name of the woman. It was like Mamie Lou or
Mamie
something.
Mamie Louie. Yeah.
I was close. So,
yeah.
Tell us very briefly.
Yeah. Her husband has a pretty vast portrait studio chain in the Seattle area called Yen Louie Photography. And he would do portraits and made quite a bit of money. He had passed away and she was living as a widow alone in her house near Seward Park, which is in Southeast Seattle. It's a high value home area, but it's really close to the ghetto. I mean, it's not too far. And so she disappeared from her front driveway at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon one day. She was abducted by, it ended up being some Asian gangbangers that abducted her. And then they made ransom demands and all this stuff. And there was, you know, we were doing surveillance on these spots. And then her body was found in a ravine, not too far away, a few days after she was kidnapped. And she'd been dead for about from the time she was kidnapped or shortly thereafter. And then we eventually got the guys, but it was kind of similar that way.
Cloyd, you must be devastated. Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks, he's leaving Seattle.
I am coming shocked because he doesn't want to pay $2 extra million a year in taxes.
He's coming my way. He's coming
he
my
is.
Way.
Yeah, that's right.
Jeff Bezos already did that. Can you imagine how the guy's worth, what, $50 billion? He doesn't want to pay $2 million in taxes.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, that's the way.
Meanwhile, one of the things, it's all over Twitter today, but someone posted a shot of Elon Musk's home in Texas. And
one of Elon Musk's home.
Well, one of his homes. This is where he spends his time. And put it this way, it doesn't look like he's worth $300 billion by the looks of his. It's unbelievable. The amount of money that guy has and where he's living is a huge.
Well, I remember one time I had to stake out Bill Gates's house.
Yeah.
He was the richest man in the world. Yeah. But he was living like a regular neighborhood at that time, driving a regular car. Because somebody has made threats against him. He since moved into, created his, you know, Hearst Castle North and moved into it. But at that time, I thought, this guy's the richest guy in the world. He had no personal security. And he would just live in a neighborhood. It was a nice neighborhood. I mean, it was expensive. But, I mean, not for the richest guy in the world. And you never know how people live, you know?
Claude, I don't want to story top you, as the kids say. But, however, in 1999, quick digression here, I had the opportunity. I don't know if it was a good one or a bad one. I still don't know. But I worked for Michael Moore as film director for the summer. Right. And he was doing a live show that aired in the UK that summer. And I was in charge of producing a couple of his segments, one of which was he reenacted all the big news that summer in the nude. That was one of his things. So
that was scary.
Yeah. Well, Stephen King got hit by a car that summer. We had to reenact that. But
that's right. I remember that year.
Michael Moore had we'd have these production meetings and he'd sit around and he'd be like, he's like, I have an idea. He's like, let's have the world's poorest man meet the world's richest man. And he sent someone to Mexico initially, but he wanted someone that did not own a pair of shoes to then go and meet Bill Gates. And he actually flew a producer and some poor guy who had no shoes out to Seattle to meet Bill Gates, to make some sort of social comment about wealth disparity in this country. Right. And it was an unmitigated disaster with Bill Gates's security team basically like almost running over the producer. And it was,
I'll bet.
but I digress here. So on to slide five here, Doug McGregor, do we get to slide five here? I don't think we did we? No. So what are we looking at here? See, you can pull it up. What are we looking at with slide five, Doug? Well, you're muted.
Apologies. This kind of goes back to, you know, where the investigation needs to start. And really, it's at victimology, because that's all we know. We know who the victim is. And, you know, you don't want to lose time in an investigation. And so it's always in one thing I always recommend, and, you know, some investigators do, some don't, is to run concurrent investigations. So from the get-go, before that Nest camera footage even come out, I mean, you have a missing person investigation and you have a criminal investigation, right? At the time, abduction, kidnapping, but you also want to look into the potential for homicide right at the bat. I mean, you have, you know, this blood evidence, you know, what reason do they have to keep her alive? So right away, you have a missing person investigation, but you have your criminal investigation. And I'd also be looking into, okay, maybe she's abducted and held somewhere, but maybe she's not, right? Maybe there's the other scenario that's not as pleasant to discuss. There's no hope involved, and that she's already deceased, right? That it was a homicide and that she's deceased. And if she is, the offender's not keeping her, right? So where's the offender going to take her? And if you're getting out of that area, you're unlikely going to take her down into the city, into Tucson, and risk getting under surveillance or pulled over or on camera or whatever. You're probably going to take her somewhere out in a rural area, you know, to dispose of the body, unfortunately. But you don't want to lose time on that. So looking at those areas out of town, into those rural areas, and getting that CCTV footage, that footage right away, is important. And if whether he had to stop for gas on the way there or the way back, kind of following that investigation route is important as well.
And Doug, I mean, what do you do about the fact that we're 38 days in now? I mean, how big an enemy is time with all this data collection?
Time is critical. I mean, it differs for what kind of warrant you're doing, what kind of provider, what kind of information you're collecting. But in general, you're looking at kind of like a 3-month window. Now, some extend to 6 months, some are less than 3 months, but for, you know, electronic data, you're kind of looking at a 3-month window, for a lot of things. For example, if you're getting phone records, my standard is kind of 3 months, some extend to 6 months, but you're kind of looking at that 3-month window. Plus, you also want to get, when you get somebody's cell phone records, which a lot of investigators don't do, you want to get everything for a suspect, for your victim, a month prior, because you have to create a spatial behavioral baseline. And you can't do that once the event has happened, because once the event has happened, the offender's behavior, it's like the timeline in, you know, the Marvel universe, right? The timeline changes forever, right? Yeah. So you have to go beforehand, and you have to create that baseline and figure out what they were doing beforehand. So it's, you know, time is critical for everything from cell phone records to getting to geofencing, tower dumps. Time is critical.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's passing way too quickly. Kathy, to you, same question I had for Cloyd, which is, during your career, particularly in homicide or otherwise, but I mean, I assume you can count on one hand the number of kidnappings/abductions. Do you have anything similar in terms of your investigative background that's like this case?
You know, they're rare. I'm actually working on a case now, sadly unresolved. It's a child abduction homicide. At least that's the best theory at the moment based on evidence. And it's from 2009. Extensive case investigation, complex. A lot of information to sort through. Other than that, I have not had a kidnapping case that I can think of off the top of my head. They do not happen all that often. I think in part because they are complex. They require a lot of planning, a lot of energy. And let's face it, most offenders are lazy. They're just not going to put the time in.
And let me ask you, in terms of, you know, we talk about victimology, but in terms of sort of a perpology here, there was discussion with Ann Burgess last night about whether whoever this is has some sort of obsession or, you know, like a stalker-like obsession with Savannah Guthrie. what does your gut tell you with all your experience in law enforcement?
I mean, that could be. She's a well-known figure. She has quite a few followers. So that would be something that you would want to take into consideration. It doesn't quite make sense yet. But again, we don't have all the information. Law enforcement obviously is going to have a lot more than we have sitting here. So it may make more sense to them. But yes, that's a good point. It's something you have to consider.
And I'm going to get back to Cloyd in a second, but Doug, a question for you. What does Doug mean by a spatial baseline?
Of course, spatial baseline is just our normal day-to-day lives, our normal routine, right? And the offender has that normal routine. You know, let's just say hypothetically, this offender, his awareness space was in the Catalina foothills and a cognitive corridor he has going through the roads that go through there. His normal routine, maybe he was a landscaper or a plumber, electrician or whatever. Let's say he's a landscaper. He goes in there with his company on a day-to-day basis. He services houses and he goes home at night, right? That's his spatial baseline. And it changes. He gets moved around. After the events happen, he's not going back there anymore. He doesn't want to be seen there anymore. He's not taking the roads in. He's not doing projects. Maybe he quit his employer. So his whole behavioral patterns, all his behavioral patterns have spatially have changed. And he's now avoiding a specific area, right? So that's kind of what I'm getting at when I discuss spatial baseline.
Okay. Thank you for that. Cloyd, there's a question from Miss Pam that I passed a while ago, but there's a big Air Force base there, Davis-Monthan, but she wants to know how come, and we don't know that they haven't done this, but would you ever put a request in for satellite imagery? Would that help? I mean, you've got Google Maps, but I assume satellite imagery can be more detailed.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm sure they're doing satellite imagery. As far as you mean live to a certain moment of satellite imagery?
I've heard
of that. I don't know how readily available it is, but certainly that would, if you have that available, that would be huge because you could see the car pull up, you could see the guys walk in and all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, if it exists in that area, you definitely would want that.
And let me ask you a question a little off base. It won't be about Michael Moore. By the way, I won his ping pong tournament in a heated final. And I got a trophy that was literally about 4.5 feet tall. That's not an exaggeration. I took it home. I won't call him a bad name, but Michael Moore asked for the trophy back. I was like, it was like Elon Musk. It's like,
yeah. And this is right. $50 on this trophy. You want it back?
Yeah. And this was his heyday. He wanted the trophy back for the following year. I was like, you can afford another trophy.
Yeah, it's also a little. I was thinking when you were telling the story of the guy with no shoes, a little hypocritical of Michael. Like you're working, hardly making any money doing anything, right?
Yeah. they call him in New York City. They've got a name for that. It's called a limousine liberal. That's what they call Michael Moore.
Exactly.
So yeah, he was looking for the guy with no shoes, but he was living a pretty cush life, Michael.
In one of his homes. Yeah.
And, he likes to. Yeah. He's in Michigan most of the year, but. Press conferences, Cloyd, this has been an unmitigated disaster from a PR perspective. And we went from yapping with these press conferences early on to releasing the crime scene. That's how Brian Enton got the shots of that blood. But now we haven't had a press conference in 1,000 days. We haven't heard from them. But what the sheriff has done is give out these sort of like bits and pieces, little interviews to different stations, and then the different media outlets start getting upset with each other. Right. Should this jurisdiction, whether it's with the sheriff or a public information officer, just hold like a weekly press briefing or every 2 weeks?
My guess is they have nothing new to report. First of all, early on in this, one thing that really torqued me off about this, they were giving up way too much information at press conferences to begin with. They were telling stuff that they shouldn't be telling. Right. And tipping their hand too much. And don't say all that stuff. Keep it in house. And that hurt them. And then, you know, releasing the house, you're right, was huge. There's no reason to release that house. So I mean, they're probably doing, and they should probably have a weekly thing with the PIO, but it's mostly going to be nothing I can share with you this week, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think even to say, hey, there's nothing new to share, is it's at least being out there and comforting.
Right. Yeah. And you let the reporters ask the questions and say, that's not something we're going to discuss today.
Exactly. Yeah. That's an old trick. You let the reporters think that they're winning. But
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know if I think Kathy may have had to leave right at 8. So thank you to her if she did. Doug, this is now slide 7 where I see geofence number 2. What the hell is geofencing, Doug? Explain the slide.
Sure. If you want to go back to the previous slide there, it's just a better close-up view there. So publicly, I've heard that they're looking into tower dumps. And tower dumps are great, and I can show everybody what a tower dump is in the last slide. And tower dumps are great because they're quick. They're a lot quicker than geofencing. You know, you get all the any cell that connected to that tower in a specific time frame, and that's a tower dump. But it has its limitations, which I can show in a minute. A geofence is a type of reverse warrant. And for a geofence warrant, you basically, you know, you kind of draw out a polygon and a time frame. So in this case, around the house, I would, you know, include the entire street, just Nancy's house, and a time frame of, let's say, 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. You know, obviously there's privacy issues around it. So if you don't include other people's houses, it kind of works out better. But that's kind of how a geofence warrant works. And then you're not getting phone information from a geofence warrant. You're going through one of the larger data collectors, and it's usually Google. And anything that has geolocation through Google, so Android devices, all your apps in your Apple phone that have location data on, and you know, I got like 50 apps plus on my phone. I have no idea, and I don't even know if they have location turned on or off. So it's really hard to control all that if you're an offender. Plus, it can hook up to Bluetooth, Wi-Fi. So you know, short of the offender's phone being off on airplane mode or left at home, you know, it can pick them up in these geofence warrants. It can take a few months to get, but that's how it works. And so I would, you know, in the slides here around her house on Route 77, which is Oracle Road.
Yeah.
And then this is up north where it splits off. And if you did travel north into a rural area to take Nancy's, you know, somewhere up there, then this would kind of pick that up. But this is just kind of an example. You got to play around with the exact area and the time frame.
And I got to tell you, having lived there, I'm sorry, Cloyd, real quick. Oracle's just it might be State Route 77, but there's a traffic light on every corner, and it's a busy, you know, relatively busy road. So if someone's trying to escape, you know, they're going to, unless they're hitting every single green light, which is not going to happen, it's going to take a while to get out of there. But go ahead, Cloyd.
I was just going to say, one of the things they have going for it, and I've done phone tower dumps before, and it's one of the things you take into account is the neighborhood and the time of day. In an urban environment, you might have 40,000 phones hitting off a tower at any given time. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this area, at 2 or 3 in the morning, it's going to be a lot smaller number. And that it's really helpful. It's more useful because it's easier. You have to feed this stuff into the computer and where are the patterns, what numbers show up here and there. And it's much more useful in a situation like this than, again, in an urban environment.
And I'm happy that Kathy's back. I thought maybe she had a run. Kathy, can you hear us?
I can. Our internet went down. I'm on my hotspot. We'll see how well this works.
Yeah, we can see you. You're bleeding a little bit, you know, internet wise, not physically. But let me I'm going to bring this video up here. This is now the perpetrator. D. Yardley in the comments said, I still can't get over how seemingly calm this person is. Kathy, if you're able to see this is the Nest cam. Do you agree? I agree that this person seems calm, seems prepared. There's no you know, rushing. It seems very kind of cool, calm, collected. Is that how you perceive it?
Yes, unusually so. It's like they don't have a care in the world. It's quite odd.
What do you make of that? I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I guess I would say I would need more information to make sense of it. It's one of those things that happens in investigations. It's an anomaly. It's something unusual. You just make note of it and hope that later on the pieces will come together and it will make sense.
Yeah. And Kathy, you know, again, it's day 39. It's day 39 today, right? It's almost getting hard to keep track of the days, but day 39. And one of the things that I have a very difficult time is understanding how you move an investigation along. I mean, on day 39, I've spoken to people in Pima County who have colleagues still working the case, and they're incredibly frustrated. What are you doing on day 39? You know, that's totally different, I guess, than day 2 or 3.
Well, it's, at some point you need to gather everybody, you need to sit down and you need to go back over and prioritize your objectives. I mean, it obviously what is happening isn't happening at the rate that everybody would like it to. So the question is, why? What do we need to do differently? Do we need to have other experts come in that can help us get where we need to go? Are we overwhelmed with information? Do we need an analyst? You know, what's the need? And then once you identify that and you can get those people in to help, that should do wonders to keep that investigation moving forward. It's easy to get bogged down. And I know Cloyd's experienced this as well. A case file can go from 10 pages to 100,000 pages quickly, and it's overwhelming trying to keep up and keep track of all that information. And if you don't have a team to do that, you're going to lose important clues, and that's going to bog you down.
Wow. Cloyd, this comment's interesting to me from Caroline Meal here. The body size of the Guthrie suspect, that's this person, not an average or proportional build. I mean, I just don't have enough experience looking at you know, security footage. But do you agree with this, that this person that is atypical, not average, that's, I guess, larger than normal?
Well, you can certainly, and they've done this, you can tell things like height and by measuring it against known things. When he's standing in the archway, how much room's between his head, the thing, because he isn't standing straight up. Mm-hmm. And then foot sizes by each of those tiles, when his foot does, how big are those tiles? They're probably a foot and things like that. So I don't know. It could be. One of the things I hear a lot, and this drives me crazy too, I talked about this just the other day. They found a glove that looks just like the glove in the picture. Well, you know what? This is an infrared picture. That could be a blue glove. It could be a red glove. It looks black in the picture, but it's not true color. So that's useless. Mm-hmm. So it's a black glove like the one I found it 2 miles away. I couldn't believe they released that as a hot tip. Found a glove 2 miles away. Yeah. It was like, come on. That's not. Yeah. If you have Nancy's DNA on the outside, or the DNA matches DNA found on the inside in the crime scene, then it's tip. But just because you found the glove 2 miles away, that was absolutely, they're throwing out stuff. And, you know, again, I don't have a problem with collecting it, but that's one of the things you keep in house until something comes of it. You know, you don't put this out as a major breakthrough in the case. It wasn't.
Yeah. Good point. Well taken. Deb Longo here, 5223. Back to Kathy. Do you think law enforcement knows who the perp or perps are and are watching him or them and just building more evidence? I mean, we don't know what we don't know. This happened in the Koberger case out in Idaho, and they were tracking him and they were working on IgG. Is it possible that, for example, the Cajun Navy was kind of rebuffed by the sheriff's offices? Maybe they have an idea of who they're looking for and where they're looking right now.
No, and I appreciate her bringing up that point. Yeah, absolutely right. And the Kohlberger case is a great example of that. And we don't know. They may already be hot on the trail. And obviously, that's going to be kept really close to the vest. They're not going to be releasing a lot of information about what they're doing, which may explain why it seems to be a little quieter now as far as information that's being released to the public and to the media. So, yeah, you bet.
Mm. Doug McGregor, I rarely do this. Actually, I never do this. But with Doug, I said, hey, Doug, just what are some questions you want asked? Because Doug's the geo profiler and I sure as hell am not. So and I know next to nothing about it. But one of them is, how did the offender enter the home? Now, I know you have to look at things like entry points and blind spots, but how do you come to a determination or what you believe to be a determination? And do you do that by day 39 where we're at?
I mean, I can make some observations and speculate, but really it's up to the investigators and the forensic team to really figure out how they entered the home. Now, after that, the big thing for me is how they entered and how they move about within the home, because I want to try and find the degree of familiarity with the home. Are they familiar with the outside of the home? Are they familiar with the inside of the home? Are they moving from room to room methodically and they know exactly where they're going? Are they tripping over things? Do they know where the cameras are? And it can help you kind of piece together who may have done this, who the suspect may be or a suspect type may be.
I'm laughing because someone's trying to sell their CrimeCon ticket and we submitted for CrimeCon. If we don't get in, I might need to buy this ticket, CEO. How dare they not admit us? Soon I'm going to have to open the gates of hell and have STS Nation tweet at CrimeCon, but we'll find out. As a matter of fact, Courtroom Confidential is going, and Josh Ritter wanted to talk a little bit about CrimeCon, but I said to him, hey, I haven't been invited yet, so I don't know if
Kathy's going too.
Oh, are you going? Oh, good.
I'll just get up with Rich as a vendor. It's different. Yeah. You pay them.
I'll sneak in with Kathy then.
Yeah.
You can hang out at my booth, Joel. I have room.
All right, I'll be there. Typically, we have a booth, but I might have to just mooch off of others. So, Kathy, one of the things I read on your bio, which is incredibly interesting, is you're a former, I guess, you still do it, but you're a tracker. What does that mean in English? No,
great question. Yes, I very much still do it. I first learned about this in 1998. I'm going to date myself here. I'm fascinated with the skill set and the science. So basically what you're doing is learning to detect the physical evidence that is always there from where people have been and how people move about. So footwear impression evidence primarily is what we're going to be talking about, but there's obviously other types of evidence that go along with human movement, evidence that DNA evidence, skin cells, hair that falls off as we're moving about. And what's so fascinating with tracking is it's applicable not just out of doors, which is what a lot of people think, but also indoors. So in this case, we have this beautiful video of this guy with the plants in hand walking back and forth on the tile. That would have been a great opportunity. And maybe they did this to get footwear impression evidence to identify the tread pattern of the boot or shoe that he is wearing. And then you can use that as you're examining around the perimeter of the home to determine how this person moved about. Were they familiar with the property? Did they go directly to the back door? Were they trying windows first? And there's all sorts of information to be gleaned just from following footwear impression evidence that can be extremely helpful. And I also look for other types of anomalies and disturbances in the ground that would indicate where somebody has laid in wait or has been standing and watching, moving about, those kinds of things.
How has tracking progressed from 1998 to 2026?
The beauty of it, it hasn't. That's the beauty of it. It's really simple. It's just training your eye and your brain to recognize and see evidence that you wouldn't normally recognize. You might see it, but your brain isn't saying, hey, that's important, because you haven't trained your eye to do that. It's an inductive, deductive piece where it just goes back and forth. So you're looking at minute details in the ground that tell you that a partial footprint that someone else didn't recognize as being a footprint is in fact a footprint, and then you can measure stride interval, where's the next print, and the next print gives you information as to how somebody is moving. Is there any quirks, anything that's identifiable about their movement? Do they have an injury? Do they have knee problems, hip problems? Are they running? Are they walking slowly, methodically, with a plan in place? Because human behavior, what we think up here, is reflected very much in how we move about on the ground.
Wow, fascinating. And I've got to digress again for 20 seconds. Please indulge me. For a honeymoon, most people are like, oh, let's go to Hawaii. I said to the COE, let's go to Rwanda and Tanzania because I'm obsessed with animals. And in Rwanda, you get to see gorillas in the wild. But how do you do it? The most coveted job in Rwanda is being a gorilla tracker. So you go in a group and there's a tracker in the front and a tracker in the back. And they were taught the gorilla language by Diane Fossey of Gorillas in the Mist. And you literally put your lives into these guys' hands and you climb through the rainforest they told us, it'll be a 20 minute walk. 3.5 hours later, and we're like in knee deep mud. Yeah. There's a literal language. As they get closer to the gorillas, the trackers start going, nom. And then all of a sudden you hear them respond. It's crazy. Then you get to spend 45 minutes, but with the gorillas, and you take pictures of them, and they're so used to humans at this point. This is what they do. We take a picture, they go like this, and then they screw with you. But the whole point of that story, Kathy, if you ever get tired of tracking humans, I've got just a place.
Go to Rwanda.
Go to Rwanda, and you're set.
The whole Irish thing doesn't work out. It sounds like I have another job opportunity in Rwanda. So good to know.
Yeah, and they are literally heroes in that country. There's no bigger job than being a gorilla tracker in Rwanda. Kudos. The other great thing about Rwanda, we had a person that was driving us to see the gorillas, and the COE was not wearing her actual engagement ring, but she was wearing a ring that looked like a diamond ring, and he didn't understand what that was. And I explained it was an engagement ring, and he still didn't understand what that was. So I explained it a little bit more, and he still didn't get it. And then he said, in Rwanda, we do not give things like rings. We give our wives goats, because with goats, you can make milk and you have food. And I thought to myself, God, we are dumb in America. What are we doing? Yeah. And I told the COE, let me have that ring back and I'll get you three goats.
And she said, nah.
Yeah, exactly. On that note, Cloyd Steiger spent a career with the Seattle Police Department in the homicide division for the last part of it. Cloyd, I got to ask you, I mean, people are getting, they're losing faith here. Will this case be solved? Your final thoughts.
Oh, I think it'll eventually be solved. I mean, like Kathy's right. There's probably a lot of stuff going on. They very well could have a guy in mind now. You just have to build enough of a case to charge him. You don't want to arrest the guy too soon. The other thing about it, you don't want to release too much information, because everything you say, this guy's paying attention to all the news and he knows whether you're close or not. You're better off letting him not know. And so he makes a mistake than to make him feel comfortable because he knows you're way off or you're close. So he starts destroying evidence. You know, that's one of the reasons you do this.
Mm. Very, very interesting. And I mean, to that point, Kathy, and by the way, Kathy is also a retired homicide out of King County, which is basically Seattle. Do you know our friend Jim Fuda? He used to be a hostage negotiator. Yeah. Everybody. Jim's now I realize Jim's the one who introduced me to Cloyd. So then obviously, yeah. I guess noticeably Jim Fuda is not part of this team. You don't have to tell me why, but, but Kathy, what are your final thoughts here? And again, tell everybody the name of your organization and what it stands for.
Yeah, IRIS, Incident Response and Investigative Strategies. And we're a team of civilian experts that will respond in partnership with law enforcement and or in support of families that are trying to work on cases that are unresolved, missing person cases. It can even be more recent criminal events, much like this case, where perhaps they need a subject matter expert such as Doug or Cloyd. We would offer up those services to help them resolve the case.
Give them the website, Kathy.
Yes.
Oh, I will do that. I'll post it.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll put it up there. While you're doing that, Doug McGregor, your final thoughts here. I mean, on day 39, what would you be most interested in from a geo profiling standpoint? If you could wave a magic wand right now, what would that ask be?
If I was working the case, I would like a couple things. One, to have an open discussion with the family. Every case I've ever worked with families, I find that's one thing that maybe a private individual, private team might be able to get certain details out of families that maybe law enforcement can't. I've experienced that on several occasions. I'm not saying there's anything hidden with the Guthrie family, but I speak with them, start putting together, people to look at. And from that list, collect things like, using these geofence warrants, finding out where they were at what time. And then progressing from there. But, there is no magic wand. It's just, I think this case, I'm not going to go so far as to say that I think it'll be solved. I think there'll be some resolution.
Interesting.
What that resolution looks like at this point, I'd like it to be solved, but I think eventually there'll be some resolution. I'm just not sure at this point what that will be.
Yeah. And just a final thought here. Kathy, to you, we're all about the victims that survive and the survivor. And you look at that photo I just had up here of Savannah and her mom. If you could speak directly to the Guthrie family tonight, what would you say to them about keeping hope alive and getting Nancy, your investigator's ability to get Nancy back home in one form or another?
Well, you have to keep hope alive. And I can't even imagine the anguish that the family must be feeling right now, the sense of hopelessness, but you have to believe that there will be answers at some point and trust that there will be answers. It's not easy. You take one day at a time, sometimes 1 hour at a time, stay together as a family, continue to ask questions, make sure you have a contact in law enforcement that is responsive to your requests and inquiries. That's going to be hugely important. You deserve that. There should be an open line of communication.
Well said. Thank you to Kathy Decker, Cloyd Steiger, Doug McGregor, the geo profiler. He's got his own channel. Kids, if you're listening at home, my kids, don't forget to feed the goats. And that's artificial grass in the back. So don't give them any artificial grass. It's bad for their stomachs. Meanwhile, let's bring Nancy home. Love you, Seattle, King County. Doug, you moved, right? You're somewhere in Canada, but you're in a different somewhere.
I am. I'm moving in. Well, 2 weeks. I'm in Ottawa right now, and which is in Ontario, and I'm moving out east to the coast, to Prince Edward Island. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's got to be beautiful, except in February. But I'll come visit you in August. So
it's spring out there. So
yeah. Shout out to Canada, and love you, Tucson. Guess stick around for one quick second. We'll see you guys tomorrow morning. The Corey Richens trial, which is a weird trial. It continues.